Stay tuned for Nightline Africa, coming up right after these latest world news headlines.
Russian forces seized the last major military base still held by the Ukraine in Crimea. And the search for the Malaysian jet continues. I'm Marty Johnson reporting from Washington. Kiev is holding a unity rally today, one day after Russian forces seized the last major Ukrainian military base in Crimea. Russian forces fired shots and used armored vehicles to smash through the gates of Belbek Air Base on Saturday. Ukrainian soldiers offered no resistance, instead singing their country's national anthem and putting their weapons into storage.
The Secretary General did ask me to stay a couple days longer.
Meantime, a United Nations envoy met with Ukrainian officials today discussing the tensions in the area and possible actions after the Russian annexation of Crimea. In spite of the talk that it would be a peaceful surrender, one Ukrainian soldier was wounded. Several reporters and cameramen had their equipment seized, including Daniel Scharf and his crew working in the area. He explains what happened.
When we were driving past the area where we had been earlier in the day, where the Russians were, and we saw that there were some armored personnel carriers there, there were some troop carriers there, and we wanted to go up and get a little bit of video of them. So we drove up actually quite close to them and started doing some taping. And then we decided a better angle would actually be a little bit further away, where we could see the nice line of them right up there at the entrance to the base. So we went further away and started doing a bit of videotaping, and then one of the big troop carriers did a U-turn, flipped around towards where we were, and it was coming past us, and then it suddenly veered off in front of our parked van, and a bunch of soldiers jumped out like a SWAT team and started screaming at us, and they knocked the cameraman down to the ground, they grabbed his camera, they came up and grabbed my camera, and they told us they would return the cameras to us later undamaged. Daniel Scharf, VOA News, Sevastopol, Crimea.
There's more on this story on our website, if you would care to look. Meantime, British Foreign Secretary William Hague, writing in a London newspaper, said Britain and its allies must prepare for different relations with Russia than they've experienced in the last 20 years. Hague said this will include restrictions on military cooperation and arms sales. Malaysian officials say they have satellite images from France showing objects afloat in an area of the southern Indian Ocean where a civilian aircraft spotted debris on Saturday. Malaysia's Ministry of Transport issued a statement today saying the images were near where Australian and Chinese satellites had captured images of large floating objects last week during the search for the Malaysian Airlines passenger jet missing since March 8th. Planes and ships spent today concentrating their search for the airliner in that area where the debris was spotted. Australian Prime Minister Tony Abbott said they still hope to find the missing jet.
It's still too early to be definite, but obviously we have now had a number of very credible leads, and there is increasing hope, no more than hope, that we might be on the road to discovering what did happen to this ill-fated aircraft.
Malaysia Air Flight 370 disappeared while traveling from Kuala Lumpur to Beijing with 239 passengers and crew on board. Turkey has shot down a Syrian warplane during fighting between Syrian rebels and government troops near the border. Turkish Prime Minister Recep Tayyip Erdogan says the Syrian plane violated Turkish airspace. Syrian state television says the plane was pursuing rebels in Syrian territory. A North Korean-flagged oil tanker that a Libyan militia illegally loaded with crude oil has returned to Libya. Officials say the Morning Glory will sail today into the port of Zawiya near the Libyan capital of Tripoli and offload its cargo. U.S. forces seized the vessel loaded with an estimated 239 barrels of oil, worth around $24 million, last week off the island of Cyprus, foiling an attempt by Libyan rebels to sell the crude oil in defiance of the government and people of Tripoli. The Baghdad bureau chief for Radio Free Iraq was shot and killed on Saturday. Witnesses say he died early Saturday and was killed by a presidential guard at the compound's gate of a checkpoint after the two argued over whose vehicle would pass through the checkpoint first. The death prompted a protest by other journalists and citizens of Baghdad calling for protection from the guard. The guard had fled the scene but was later handed over to authorities. Iraq's Prime Minister Nouri al-Maliki met briefly with the journalist's family and has promised them swift action. I'm Marty Johnson, VOA News in Washington. More news, voanews.com.
Good evening. This is Nightline Africa. We are coming to you live from the English service of the Voice of America. I'm Douglas Mpoga.
And I'm Odette Frazier. Thanks for joining us.
Everybody that has been in contact with suspected patients or confirmed patients, we follow them up in the period of the incubation time, and the period that these people also can fall sick.
An outbreak of a deadly Ebola virus in Guinea.
It's a very promising sector which we intend to valorize, but mining processes are usually lengthy and the populations expecting to find jobs in the sector must be patient.
A campaign to identify more of the true magnitude of Cameroon's mineral wealth.
These 27 countries only reported about 10,000 MDR-TB cases. By 2012, the number of MDR-TB cases that were notified by these countries tripled.
And we'll look at advances in the treatment of tuberculosis. Those stories and more coming up on Nightline Africa.
Doctors Without Borders has launched an emergency medical intervention in southern Guinea in response to an outbreak of viral deadly fever. Guinea's Ministry of Health said the highly contagious virus, which is believed to be caused by the Ebola virus, has killed at least 34 people. Jane Falazuta has more from VOA's West African Bureau in Dakar.
Guinea's Ministry of Health declared Friday that an outbreak of a rare and deadly form of the Ebola virus has reached epidemic proportions. The ministry said there have been 49 reported cases of the virus since early February. At least 34 people have died. In response to the outbreak, the international medical organization Doctors Without Borders, MSF, says it has partnered with the Ministry of Health to control the spread of the virus. MSF says it currently has a 24-member medical team on the ground to treat suspected cases. More staffers are scheduled to arrive in Guinea in coming days. Dr. Esther Sterk is a tropical disease specialist for MSF.
We have set up an isolation ward in Gekedu. It's one of the places where cases have been seen. So in this isolation unit, we are treating the patients. And also what we do, everybody that has been in contact with suspected patients or confirmed patients, we follow them up in the period of the incubation time, and the period that these people also can fall sick.
Sterk said an additional isolation ward will be set up in Macenta, where there have also been suspected cases of the virus. MSF said that more than 30 tons of medical supplies are now en route from Belgium and France to Guinea, including medications to ease the symptoms of the fever and equipment for isolation chambers. This is the first time that such a virus has been identified in Guinea. Guinea's Ministry of Health said that French scientists confirmed Saturday that at least some of the cases of the outbreak were caused by the Ebola virus. This particular strain of the virus is initially contracted from contact with contaminated rodent feces. It is then spread among humans through bodily fluids, such as sweat, saliva, and blood. Symptoms include high fever, vomiting, diarrhea, and in some cases, bleeding. The WHO says Ebola is one of the most highly contagious viral diseases. It results in death in between 25 and 90% of cases. The virus cannot be prevented with a vaccine and is untreatable with medication.
There's no curative treatment, but there is symptomatic treatment. So people have fevers. We give something against the fever to reduce the fever. People can have diarrhea and vomiting, so we give fluids, IV fluids. People have often a lot of pain, so we give painkillers. So for the containment of the outbreak, it's very important that sick patients will be isolated and receive treatment in isolation ward.
The Ministry of Health says it has begun to educate the population about the symptoms of the virus and the importance of rapid treatment. Jennifer Lazuda for VOA News, Dakar.
The government of Sierra Leone will host a performance assessment meeting for all state institutions this week. Government ministries, departments and agencies are expected to sign performance contracts to which they will be held accountable at year end. Eunice Asise is the director of communications in the office of the president. I reached him in Freetown to find out the objective of signing the performance contracts.
The objective of the performance contracting process actually is to integrate goals, strategies, resources being expended, and the processes so as to improve the capacity, ensure services, same time enhance transparency and accountability.
How effective will this contract be in terms of addressing issues that the government ministries may have?
Every government ministry has got their own mandate, and they are supposed to perform certain specific functions. And this contracting is a freely negotiated agreement between the institutions and the what we call the performance service delivery management directorate, the directorate within the State House. Therefore, these people are freely negotiating contracts with these institutions for them to commit themselves on what they are supposed to do, so that the process itself monitors, in fact, the extent to which they go to achieve those objectives and how efficient they are using the resources allocated to them.
Is it safe to say that there have been some issues that triggered these contracts?
There have been challenges over the years in terms of efficiency. Don't forget also that we are coming from a war and we're in a hurry to do so many things. You know, and this current government, as you know, is involved in a lot of transformation projects. Therefore, we want to make sure that the little limited resources we have to use them to achieve our objectives, not to waste them, because there have been a lot of loopholes, there have been a lot of resources wasted.
How will the performance be measured?
They are signing contracts that the deliverables which they signed to. A few months ago, there was a whole 5 days getting together of all the institutions where they are going to present what they have been doing. They are evaluated by their peers. Then a team is sent round from State House, the strategy and policy units, and the performance directorate. They go out into the countryside to verify, to validate some of the claims they make about achieving and things they are doing. Now, this team comes up with these results. And then the last thing is to analyze some of these findings in the field and also analyze, because constantly there's interaction between the strategy and policy units with all of these ministries.
Will the ministries, departments or agencies be rewarded for performing well during the year?
Absolutely. We are starting it this year to give awards, and again it will be there on Tuesday. They are going to be rewarded, and those we don't perform is going to be the basis of taking decisions to look at the way forward, how this institution will be better managed. Those who perform below expectation are going to be sanctioned.
How is this going to benefit the people of Sierra Leone?
To make sure that perform their functions for which they are set up in a transparent way, in an accountable way, to make sure that the people receive the services which they expect, to make sure that individuals don't take advantage of their position. Every single one of these institutions, they have probably what they call a service charter. There's a service charter which is prominently displayed in all of these institutions, so the public know what to expect. These are the things we are trying to create so that we get accountability, transparency, efficient delivery of service.
Eunice Asise, the Director of Communications in the Sierra Leone's Office of the President.
Meanwhile, in Cameroon, the government has for decades boasted about its treasure trove of assorted minerals. However, the claim hinges on a survey made more than four decades ago of only 40% of this vast Central African country. Authorities are banking on an aerial survey with sophisticated technology that can identify more of the true magnitude of mineral wealth concealed beneath the 457,000 square kilometers of Cameroon. From Douala, Ntareke Divine Jr. picks up the story.
Despite the aging claim advertising Cameroon as home to some of Africa's largest reserves of varied minerals, global mining industry giants including Australia's Sundance, Korea's CNK Mining, Canada's Rio Tinto Alcan and China's Sinosteel, among others, have continued rushing in. To date, the government has issued nearly 170 exploration permits, enabling the mineral-hungry investors to probe the country's remotest parts, digging around for leads to possibly buried deposits of bauxite, uranium, diamond, rutile, zinc, iron ore, nickel, cobalt, manganese, natural gas, and oil. Swelling numbers of new finds have recently inspired fresh government interest in expanding its understanding of the country's available mineral wealth. The Ministry of Mines, Industries and Technological Development has launched a mineral stocktaking venture across parts of the unexplored 60% of territory making up Cameroon. Cameroon's mining sector has frequently come under fire for failing to assume its ascribed role as Cameroon's engine to drive new industry and more jobs. Mining currently contributes a meager 6% to the country's revenue in the annual budget. Emmanuel Bonde is Cameroon's Minister of Mines, Industries and Technological Development. He says the plan is to raise that amount to 10% in the coming years. He adds that the geophysical survey will help streamline the sustainable management of the country's mineral potentials.
It's a very promising sector which we intend to valorize. But mining processes are usually lengthy, and the populations expecting to find jobs in the sector must be patient, because there is no need to rush to get up with mistakes like auctioning our mineral wealth.
Starting in January of this year, four small aircraft flying at altitudes as low as 80 meters will become a familiar scenario for residents of six of the country's 10 administrative regions. The small airplanes are fitted with special sensors enabling the visualization of subsurface geological structures. Guillaume Sosten Mananga, coordinator for World Bank-funded Mining Sector Capacity Building Project, manages the National Minerals Assessment that launched in 2011. He says the aerial geophysical survey will cover 160,000 square kilometers in six regions: the Adamawa, Center, East, North, Littoral, and West regions. That's about a third of Cameroon's total surface. By June 2015, the project is expected to culminate in the identification of new reserves. The operation will cost 2.1 billion francs CFA, about 4.2 million in US dollars, and is being performed by Canada Geotech Airborne Limited, which has been doing similar aerial surveys for 30 years. Using aeromagnetic techniques, which are increasingly employed in studying the Earth's properties, the geophysicists say they will produce for Cameroon 13 new geological maps, up from one currently, as well as expand the size of explored portions of Cameroon's territory from 40 to 70%. Experts say apart from being more modern, efficient, and rapid, the survey is also environmentally friendly, as it rules out the need for exploration excavations. According to the World Bank, the project will eventually contribute in enhancing efficiency and transparency in the mining sector, and also improve the frameworks for sustainable mining development. From Douala in Cameroon, I'm Tariq Divine Jr. for VOA News.
There's good news and some sobering news to report on World TB Day Monday. The good news: there are new drugs, new tests, and a promising vaccine being developed. The bad news: drug resistance is common, and a multi-drug resistant strain of TB is being called a global threat. VOA's Carl Pearson has more, including an interview with Dr. Anthony Fauci, head of the Infectious Diseases Division at the U.S. National Institute of Health.
Tuberculosis is an old disease that remains a global problem. Even though the World Health Organization reports the death rate has dropped to nearly half of what it was 20 years ago, Dr. Anthony Fauci heads the Infectious Diseases Division at the U.S. National Institutes of Health.
One third of the world's population is infected with tuberculosis latently. They're not sick, but they potentially could get sick because they have tuberculosis in them.
Most of those infected with TB live in developing countries, and people with HIV have a high risk of developing TB.
Each year, there are over 8 million new infections with tuberculosis whereby people become ill.
1,300,000 people died from TB last year. The medical aid group, Doctors Without Borders, warns that drug-resistant TB has become a global threat. Tuberculosis is caused by bacteria. It's spread by cough. In Chicago, Dr. Dean Schroffnagel treats about 200 TB patients a year. He spoke to VOA by Skype.
Treatment is prevention, because once you treat a single case, then that person is no longer able to spread it to anyone else.
The problem is the billions who don't know they have TB are not in treatment or stop taking their medicine. But despite this, both doctors say there's good news. First, Dr. Fauci.
Over the last 10 or so years, the number of cases and the number of deaths from tuberculosis has come down, mostly through public health measures.
We can't let up. We can't say, okay, we've made some progress. We don't need to do more.
That's because it's clear that if TB is not controlled early and drug-resistant strains spread, the world will face a much deadlier threat. Carol Pearson, VOA News.
Meanwhile, the World Health Organization reports tens of thousands of people with the multi-drug-resistant form of TB are now getting treatment for this disease thanks to new diagnostic tools. In advance of World TB Day on Monday, WHO says a project started 5 years ago is making progress in diagnostic MDR-TB patients who formerly were missed. Lisa Schlein reports for VOA from WHO headquarters in Geneva.
The World Health Organization says nearly 500,000 people worldwide fell ill with multidrug-resistant tuberculosis in 2012. Yet fewer than one in four of these people were diagnosed, mainly because they did not have access to the proper diagnostic services. 5 years ago, the World Health Organization and several partner agencies started a project in 27 low and middle-income countries in an effort to reach people with MDR-TB who are falling through the cracks of their country's health systems. The director of WHO's Global TB Program, Mario Raviglioni, says the project, known as Expand TB, has made progress in ferreting out many of these missed patients. He notes more than 70,000 new cases of MDR-TB were discovered in the 27 countries in 2012.
In 2008, that was a year before we started the project, these 27 countries only reported about 10,000 MDR-TB cases. By 2012, the number of MDR-TB cases that were notified by these countries tripled. In India, for instance, and it's probably one of the best examples, that is the largest recipient of Expand TB support, 16,000 people with MDR-TB were detected in 2012 with support from, again, this project. It used to be 4,000 or 5,000, so, you know, it really increased dramatically.
The 27 countries involved in the project, including 12 from Africa, are found in all regions of the world. Together, they carry 40% of the estimated global MDR-TB burden. The Global Health Initiative, known as UNITAID, is providing $87 million to support Expand TB. Another organization called FIND is the main implementing partner. Chief Executive Officer of FIND, Katharina Böhm, says diagnostics influences about 70% of healthcare decisions. Yet, she adds, only 3 to 5% of healthcare spending goes for diagnostics. She says traditional diagnostic tests for TB can take more than 2 months to get results. However, she notes new technologies now make it possible to rapidly diagnose TB and drug-resistant TB in as little as 2 hours.
In addition to the immediate benefit to patients, Expand TB also, however, has paved the way to the uptake and rapid uptake of future diagnostic tests. FIND is currently aiming to address, in collaboration with multiple R&D partners, the most urgent needs. A rapid TB test for testing at community level to cut transmission, and a rapid test for extended drug resistance detection, which will be crucial also for the uptake of new drugs that are in the pipeline.
Tuberculosis is contagious and spreads through the air. South Asia and Africa account for nearly two-thirds of all missed cases. Most people can be cured of regular TB by taking a six-month course of drugs at a cost of around $30. In comparison, it takes about 2 years to treat people with MDR-TB. WHO says the complex regimen of drugs needed to treat the disease can run into tens of thousands of dollars in wealthy countries. However, negotiations with pharmaceutical companies have reduced the cost of these drugs to around $1,800 for patients in developing countries. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
Uganda has a new television news program featuring rappers presenting current events in verse. One is a 13-year-old girl. As Hilary Hewler reports for VOA from Kampala, the program helps to reach out to the young and to push the boundaries of social commentary.
Uganda has the youngest population in the world. 7 out of 10 people are less than 30 years old. 8 out of 10 are unemployed, even with a degree or diploma. Finding work is still a drama, too many jobs.
Zoe Kabuye, aka MC Loy, knows the problems of Ugandan youth. The rapper herself is only 13 years old and just started secondary school. But she's also a rising TV star, one of three journalists on a new program in which the news is presented through rap.
It shows what takes place in the country, and we talk about it. Mostly the youth don't like to watch news, but a couple of them like rap. And so in form of what we do, it will attract them to listen to the news.
Presenter Daniel Chiseka, a.k.a. Survivor, has been in the music industry for decades. But journalism, he says, is different from anything he's done before.
It involves a lot of research. So you have to dig deep so that you don't give wrong information. And you have to be critical of both sides. You have to be objective so that you represent everybody in fairness.
But, he adds, they don't want to be too objective.
That is kind of our extra bonus. You can play around a bit.
Another idea can be to start up a new religion. Every another day, a pastor makes a million. One Nigerian pastor, Priniwa, is particularly blessed. He has a Rolls Royce and a private jet.
He prays on the weak and knows how to speak. Hands you a check as you turn the other cheek. He
will take the rappers cover everything from entertainment news to politics, often with sharp barbs of social commentary thrown in among the rhymes. Producer Arnold Aganze says their medium, music, lets them say things other journalists might not.
Sometimes I even think journalists have kind of borders, but us, we are just like artists who are singing, so we can sing whatever we want. We don't hide talking about any topic, we can just sing.
Recent episodes have poked fun at Uganda's Anti-Pornography Act, widely believed to have banned miniskirts. And as for the country's harsh new anti-homosexuality law, the rappers compared it to anti-Semitism in Nazi Germany. In Uganda, says Aganze, that is pushing the envelope.
I'm sure we are the only one who made the mix of the two things. We have been like, hey, are we treating these guys like the way Jama used to treat Jewish?
But even rappers can only go so far. Human rights groups report that media freedom in Uganda is eroding. And last year, two national newspapers were shut down by the government for over a week. Survivor says he and the other rappers know that there are limits to what they can write.
This is now journalism, and there's a thin line between what you can say and what you can't say, so we have to be careful. I've met other journalists that kind of give you that kind of caution, that, hey, yeah, what you're doing is nice, but you have to be careful. Otherwise, they'll shut you down before you continue. There's a threat, but we'll try our best.
What they say is important because the youth are listening, says Survivor, especially to the teenaged MC Loy. They might not read newspapers or watch the normal newscasts, he says, but they do need to know what's happening in Uganda.
Because it's their country. It is their destiny. They're going to inherit a lot of baggage. We are no longer in a world where your village is your world. They have to know what's going on out there.
Rap can entertain, but it can also empower, he says. If you want to reach young people, Survivor adds, you have to speak to them in their own language. Hilary Hewler for VOA News, Kampala.
Hello, I'm Kim Lewis.
And I'm Yehiyas Wuhib.
Together we host the Voice of America's informative program, Africa News Tonight.
We present a thorough summary of the day's events, featuring interviews with newsmakers in Africa and the world.
Also, Sunny Young drops in live with sports, and we have features on science, health, and business.
Tune in.
This is the Voice of America, and you're listening to Nightline Africa.
And coming up in the second half of the program, sports with Asegun Adeyemi from the Nigerian commercial capital Lagos, music from our African collection for your listening pleasure and indeed relaxation.
And that will be followed by a commentary by Dr. James Jonah, former UN Undersecretary General for Political Affairs.
Well, let's kick off with Nightline Africa Sports, and for that, let's go straight to Lagos and join Asegun on the dot at DMA. Good evening, Asegun.
Good evening, Douglas, and good evening, Africa. Welcome to Nightline Africa Sports for Sunday, March 23rd. First leg matches in the round of 16 have been played this weekend in Africa's two club football competitions, the CAF Champions League and the CAF Confederation Cup. The aggregate winners in the round of 16 of the Champions League will advance to the lucrative mini-league stage. And the aggregate winners in the same round of the Confederation Cup will progress to the playoff round, where they will be joined by the round of 16 losers in the CAF Champions League. In some of the results of this weekend's matches, Champions League title holder Al Ahly of Egypt lost by a lone goal to Ali Benghazi of Libya on Friday in Tunis. Zimbabwe import Edward Sadumda scored the goal in the 67th minute, cashing in on a blunder by Al Ahly captain Wael Goma to give his side a first leg advantage. It was the second successive loss for eight-time champion Al Ahly after suffering a similar fate against Tanzanian champions Young Africans in the previous round in Dar es Salaam. But for the Libyans, it was a well-deserved win, despite playing away from their favorite ground in Benghazi. Egypt's other club in the tournament, Zamalek, was more fortunate. Zamalek kept a clean sheet in the competition for the fifth successive game by holding Nkana FC to a goalless draw in Zambia. The five-time African champions are now favorites to reach the group stage as they bid to win their first continental trophy since 2002. The return leg match will be played in the Egyptian Red Sea Resort of El Guna next week. In another result, Real Bamako of Mali and Esperance of Tunisia played 1-1. Turning to the CAF Confederation Cup, Rwandan club AS Kigali, Etoile du Sahel of Tunisia, Haumine of Zimbabwe, and Wadi Delga of Egypt all posted first leg victories on Saturday. AS Kigali utilized home advantage to peep Moroccan club Difa Hassani El Jadidi 1-0. Haumine defeated visiting Bayelsa United of Nigeria 2-1. Host Etoile du Sahel managed to beat Super Sport United of South Africa by a lone goal, while Wadi Delga, playing at home, outclassed Joliba AC of Mali 2-0. As I reported earlier, the aggregate winners of the round of 16 of the Confederation Cup will go into a playoff with the losers in the round of 16 of the Champions League for places in the group stage of the Confederation Cup. Let's now head to Dakar, the capital city of the West African nation of Senegal. That's where African sports journalists gathered during the past week for their congress under the platform of the African chapter of the International Sports Press Association, AIPS. Organizers say the congress set a record in the number of countries that were represented. They say journalists from 21 countries were present, compared with the highest of 15 countries previously recorded. Michel Obi is the president of the AIPS Africa. He calls the record attendance a good beginning for an association that has been struggling to find its level. Obi also spoke of the overall objectives of the Congress.
This Congress for us, it's a turning point in the direction of the way we want African sports journalists to not only match their counterparts globally, but also to find a new way of using technology and also changing her professional approach to working, to making the best of her situation and also giving value to sports journalism. So for us, it's a turning point in the way we perceive our profession and the way we handle our profession and the way we are going to do our profession. This Congress at least will fashion a new vision, a new direction. For me particularly, it's my first Congress as the president of AIPS, and I want to believe that it's time for us to go to work. It's time for us to work and make our Congress a true journalistic engagement, one that will be the pride of all sports journalists, not only in the continent, but also African journalists outside.
That was the president, African chapter of the International Sports Press Association, AIPS, Michel Obi. Many thanks to reporter Tony Atkins for the audio. In African athletics, Mustafa Al-Gamel of Egypt has smashed the African hammer record. Al-Gamel added 66 centimeters to the African record on Friday, throwing a world-leading 81.29 meters at a low-key competition in the Egyptian capital, Cairo. The 25-year-old added more than 3 meters to his previous best of 77.73 meters set last year at the Solidarity Games, in breaking the African record of 80.63 meters set by South Africa's Chris Harms in 2005, Al-Gamel also surpassed the Egyptian record of 78.21 meters set last year by compatriot Hassan Mohamed Mahmoud. Turning to the ongoing FIFA Under-17 Women's World Cup in Costa Rica, two of Africa's three representatives are through to the quarterfinals. Ghana and Nigeria advanced to the last eight, while Africa's third team, Zambia, has been eliminated, despite winning its last group match 2-1 against the hosts on Saturday. Ghana won two matches and lost one to finish on top of Group B with 6 points. For its part, Nigeria has won its two matches so far and is now tied with Mexico on 6 points atop Group D. Finally, it is now 81 days to the kickoff of the 2014 FIFA World Cup in Brazil, and the countdown continues. On Saturday, tournament organizers and World Soccer's governing body, FIFA, performed an embarrassing U-turn and apologized, saying it had withdrawn publicity material for the World Cup that poked fun at local customs. FIFA says it has removed material which depicted Brazilians as unpunctual, impatient, and even chaotic, having regularly complained to Brazil about the slow pace of construction of stadiums for the World Cup. Football's world governing body felt moved to add, in Brazil, things are largely done last minute. FIFA admitted its attempt at humor had backfired. The material was lighthearted and at no time was meant to criticize Brazil, a FIFA statement said. It says the objective was to show the laid-back characteristics of the Brazilian people. Meanwhile, Brazil is to declare no-fly zones over the stadiums to be used for the World Cup to prevent terrorist attacks during the tournament. But there is a catch. The Brazilian Air Force that will enforce the no-fly zones can't shoot down intruders for now. By law, Brazil's military can only shoot at unresponsive civilian planes on drug trafficking routes near its borders, but not over densely populated urban areas where games will be played in 12 cities. The Air Force is asking the Brazilian government to change the shoot-down law to allow effective defense of the airspace during the 64 games of the June 12th to July 13th Global Soccer Tournament. And Brazil's first World Cup winning captain has died. Eldorado Luiz Bellini, who captained the triumphant 1958 side, has died in Sao Paulo at the age of 83. He had been suffering from Alzheimer's for many years. Bellini led the side, including players such as Garrincha, Zagallo, and a 17-year-old Pelé. The Brazilians beat host Sweden 5-2 in the final to win the first of a record 5 World Cup titles. Bellini was part of the squad that lifted the trophy in Chile 4 years later, although he never played in that tournament. He got the last of his 51 caps at the 1966 World Cup in England. A statue built outside Rio de Janeiro's Maracanã Stadium, which will host the 2014 World Cup final on July 13th, shows Bellini holding aloft the trophy he led his team to win in 1958. That ends it for this weekend's edition of Nightline Africa Sports. Thanks a lot for listening. I'm Segun Adeyemi in Lagos. Now sending it back to Douglas the Mighty Mpuga in Washington.
Thank you, Segun. Segun on the dot, Adeyemi will be back again next Sunday for another look at Africa Sports right here on Nightline Africa.
It's Sunday on Nightline Africa, and this is the time for music from the continent. Enjoy.
I got to go, can you name? naona umeshindwa kubadilisha akatuko kangu we I let you go mkwano unaniumiza sana ninateseka ndani moyoni mimi nauma akatuko kangende I let you go sitawe nimekufia sana utaki change naona umeshindwa kubadilisha akatuko kangu we I let you go mkwano nunya
pete ya rusi ninayo kidole nilikupenda ba baby sorry utapata mwingine don't you worry watoto tumezaa tuna wote yale tulipanga mimi na wewe milele lakini nini unanichanganya maisha wote wawili tulipanga shida ni nyingi hatujakosana haingekuwa hivyo unapenda upendi mpenzi tu achane na hivyo hivyo
hizi sana ninateseka ndani moyoni mimi nauma
Kangende,
I need to go.
Sita wesa.
Nimekumilia sana, utaki change na wano meshinwa kubadilisha.
I got to go, kangupowe.
I need to go,
mukwano.
Unaniumiza sana, ninateseka, nani moyoni mimi nauma.
I got to go, kangende,
I need to go.
Sita wesa. Nimekumilia
sana, utaki change na wano meshinwa kubadilisha.
I got to go, kangupowe.
Chico mukwano
nibati unayempenda sana kupata lipo aitweza beli atakula za mtu anakula zake sipo nipe changu na mimi nikupe chako kama unipendi hilo ni fako we got a lot of issues to say to pamoja twende mseto love me baby I will love you but scratch my back I will scratch your back not this way unapenda upendi
unaniumiza sana ninateseka ndani moyoni mimi nauma
I got to go kangende
and that was a Sunday music spot from Nightline Africa here at the English service of the Voice of America.
Now let's take a closer look at Africa. One man's point of view, a commentary by Dr. James Joyner, a former UN Undersecretary General for Political Affairs. Take it away, Dr. Joyner.
Good evening, Africa. The people of Sierra Leone are bidding farewell to their former president, Ahmed Tidjane Kabah, today, who recently passed away at age 82. Kabah, as he is fondly called by many Sierra Leoneans, was neither a professional politician nor a power-hungry leader. After many years as an international civil servant at the United Nations, he returned home after retirement with the aim of opening a private legal practice with his wife, Pat, who was also a lawyer. Although he was not comfortable with military regimes, he accepted with his keen sense of duty to serve as a chairman of an advisory group set up by the National Provision Ruling Council, NPRC, government. With the return of political activities in Sierra Leone, he became the reluctant presidential candidate of the SLPP, and in a democratic election in March 1966, Kabah was elected president in a multi-party election. In fact, he faced formidable challenges. He inherited a brutal civil war that began in 1991. If the truth be told, Kabah was well prepared for the tasks at hand. As a civil servant in the country, he had served as deputy district commissioner in many duty stations around the country. He spoke not only multiple national languages, he knew the country extremely well. Kabah made the search for peace and national reconciliation a top priority. To the discomfort of his party, he included in his cabinet professionals who did not belong to any political party. He wanted to mobilize all the available talents in the country to build a strong economy and a viable nation. But he clearly understood that without peace with the nation's adversaries, nothing much could be done. Accordingly, only a few months after he was inaugurated, he signed in November 1966 the Abidjan Agreement with Fodor Sankoh of the RUF, Revolutionary United Front. But instead of strengthening the peace, the so-called Armed Forces Revolutionary Council, AFRC, launched a coup on 25th March 1997, and Pakaba went into exile in Conakry. The event was a traumatic experience for many Sierra Leoneans. They had gone through so much pain and agony to elect their president in a democratic election in March 1966. And now, military was back again. Fortunately, the people strongly supported the president and refused to cooperate with the AFRC illegal government. The international community rallied to their side, and no international government recognized the regime. At the OAU summit in Harare, Zimbabwe, few weeks later, the Continental Organization denounced the coup and declared that the OAU would no longer accept any unconstitutional change of regime. This was the first time it was done by the OAU. ECOWAS, under the leadership of Sani Abacha of Nigeria, pledged to restore constitutional rule in Sierra Leone. In March 1998, that promise was fulfilled when President Kaba was welcomed home by a huge crowd in the national stadium. But President Kaba faced greater challenges than before. The economy had collapsed, and it was necessary to devise imaginative and resourceful measures to rectify the situation. However, these initiatives were seriously frustrated when the RUF forces entered Freetown on 6th of January 1999, and a large part of the city was destroyed with human casualties. However, when the rebels were eventually routed out of the city, Pakaba, ever optimistic, resumed his search for peace and national reconciliation. In the face of serious doubts about the seriousness of the RUF by members of his cabinet, Pakaba renewed his readiness to negotiate with Fode Sankoh. Accordingly, it was by dint of his dogged persistence that it was possible to conclude the Lomé Peace Accord on 27th March 1997. Pakaba then encouraged Fode Sankoh and Johnny Paul Kuruma to take up residence in Freetown to facilitate close contacts. Both men worked under the chairmanship of the president to deal with the crucial disarmament, demobilization, and reintegration program, DDR. In the meantime, with the strong support of the international community, including the World Bank and the IMF, Pakaba focused his attention on building a strong economy. But alas, Fode Sankoh and his band of rebels did not grasp the chance for peace. When Fode Sankoh was finally captured, the prospect for peace increased. This made it possible for Pakaba to declare on 18th January 2002 that the war had ended in Sierra Leone.
That commentary by Dr. James Jonah. Thank you.
Nightline Africa comes to you from the English service of the Voice of America.
Thanks for joining us tonight. I hope you enjoyed the program. And as you know by now, we are on air on Saturdays and Sundays at 16 and 18 hours UTC. I'm Douglas Mpoga.
And hope you'll join us again on Saturday. I'm Odette Fraser. Have a good evening.
Good evening.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
Rising political tensions in Burundi ahead of next year's elections have sparked violent clashes between police and opposition activists in recent days. Actions taken by both sides are inconsistent with the Central African nation's notable progress toward creating a peaceful democracy. In two separate incidents on March 8th, government officials took action to break up political gatherings being held by two different opposition parties. Police used heavy-handed tactics to stop a peaceful rally by the women's wing of United for National Progress to mark International Women's Day. Later, police dispersed a gathering of another political opposition party, some of whose members subsequently congregated at the headquarters of the Movement for Solidarity and Democracy political party, or MSD. Two police officers attempting to arrest three MSD members who had taken refuge in the headquarters were taken hostage by opposition members. Following unsuccessful mediation, police assaulted the building to free the hostages. The police and opposition members exchanged live fire during this confrontation. Authorities later issued an arrest warrant on insurgency charges for the MSD's chairman, Alexis Sinduije. The United States deplores the acts of violence by both government officials and opposition members in the incidents, which follow a series of restrictions placed on civil and political rights in Burundi. Restricting public gatherings in this way has a chilling effect on public debate. We urge the government of Burundi to adhere to its human rights obligations and to respect the constitutional right of the political opposition to hold peaceful gatherings. It is also imperative that all sides refrain from the kind of violence seen in the March 8th clashes. It is important that all sides respect the democratic process so that Burundi can hold free, fair, transparent, and peaceful elections in 2015.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government. If you have a comment, please write to Editorials, VOA, Washington, D.C., 20237, USA. You may also comment and view all our current editorials at the VOA Editorials homepage, www.voanews.com/editorials.